for the United States Court of Appeal for Benton Claims. Draw nigh and give your attention, for this honorable court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
This is case number 02, I'm right when I say that, right? 02-1604, Mark A. Stover versus the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, James Nicholson. Who will speak for Mr. Stover?
I will, Your Honor. Dave Landers, representing Appellant Mark Stover.
And who will speak for the Secretary?
Thomas Sullivan, Your Honor. And with me at counsel table is Gail Stroman.
With me at counsel table is Landon Overby.
Before we begin, I do have one administrative matter that I want to take care of. This case has been delayed for a number of reasons, one of which was compliance with Canon 3D of the Code of Judicial Ethics, and which there's a procedure established when there's a potential conflict in the case. As I hope counsel will recall, that we followed that procedure because prior to my joining the court, I was counsel in a case that is cited for, distinguished, and discussed by both parties, the case of Kinnaman. And so out of an abundance of caution, we followed these procedures, which involves the clerk of the court sending a document to both parties and obtaining a waiver from them of any potential disqualification on my part. Although I have not seen those documents, the clerk has informed me that both sides have in fact waived any potential conflict that might be as a result of my participation in that case that you've relied upon. Do both parties confirm that at this time?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you very much. The clerk will make those documents a part of the record of this case. Mr. Landers, you may begin.
And I would like to reserve 10 minutes, if I could, Your Honor.
Certainly.
Appellant has advanced two assignments of error in this case. First, after properly finding that the presumption of aggravation arose, the board erred in finding that this presumption was rebutted by clear and unmistakable evidence that the increase in disability was due to natural progress. Second, the board erred in concluding that the service department's favorable line of duty determination was either irrelevant or patently inconsistent with VA criteria. A favorable ruling on either assignment of error by this court would result in the grant of benefits to Mr. Stover. Since the court has shown a particular interest in appellant's second assignment of error regarding 38 CFR 3.1M, I'll address that argument first, if I may. There's no patent inconsistency between VA criteria and those utilized by the service department for determining service connection or the equivalent thereof. An award of VA compensation requires a grant of service connection for disability resulting from disease or injury incurred in or aggravated by service. An award of disability severance pay by the service department requires a favorable line of duty determination regarding incurrence or aggravation during service. Both VA and the service department define aggravation as an increase in severity or worsening, and you'll see these words used interchangeably, of a pre-existing disability beyond natural progress. Two references in this regard are Title 38 CFR Section 3.306B and the last paragraph on page 40 of DOD Instruction 1332.38, which was in the supplemental materials submitted by appellant. And I might mention the nomenclature of the paragraphing in the DOD instructions is so confusing. I just think it's easier perhaps if I refer to a page than rattle off about 10 different numerals or digits. Both establish a presumption of aggravation when there is an increase or worsening during service. Again, I cite 38 CFR 3.306B for VA and page 21 on DOD instruction 38.
Counsel, you're referring to beyond the normal progression of a disease. Is that correct or not?
Yes, Your Honor. Increase in severity or worsening beyond the natural or normal progress or progression of the
So even condition. Though none of this discussion was contained in the, appellant's separation from service, we should presume that all this occurred.
Appellant was awarded severance pay, and severance pay by law can only be awarded for disability incurred or aggravated.
So under the presumption of regularity, we're presuming that the service made this finding?
Yes. Now, it's possible, Your Honor, that not all the documents that were prepared by the service department surfaced. I went through the claims folder myself and could not find any additional documents, but that might be part of the problem. But one key document, I believe, and I think it's at record 173, I may be mistaken on that, but in any event, it shows that with application of the VA rating schedule, the service department determined that the disability was non-compensable, left foot disability, when Mr. Stover entered service and was rateable at 10% when he was separated from service. Therefore, it went from 0 to 10%, and hence the increase in severity and aggravation.
Counsel, is there any specific medical evidence that indicates the worsening of the disability was due to the service?
Your Honor, are you referring to the medical evidence from the service records or
any medical evidence?
Well, from the service records, yes, there's a summary from the Rota Hospital, and there are also statements from the medical board signed by two individuals with MC after their rank indicating medical corps.
Beyond the natural progression of the disease?
Had it not been beyond the natural progression, severance pay could not have been awarded. Now, okay. I'm not sure if the specific words increase or worsening beyond natural progression appear in the available records, but that is a prerequisite for a grant of disability severance pay, and I believe Judge Sholin referred to the presumption of regularity as far as the service department would follow its own directives and regulations in this matter.
Okay. I'd like you to be as specific as possible about why you believe there's a necessary finding that the disability that Mr. Stover incurred increased beyond the normal progression of his disability. And by specific, I mean point me to the paragraphs that you're going to rely on here and their relationship to documents that are in the record.
Well, one paragraph I'm relying on, Your Honor, is found on page 40 of DOD Instruction 1332.38, which defines aggravation as...
I understand that. Now, go ahead.
Permanent service aggravation. This is a different spot now. My co-counsel has referred me to, but this is page 7 of DOD Instruction 1332.39. It deals specifically with pre-existing disabilities. It's 6.11.1, permanent service aggravation. Considered permanently.
I'm going to try to follow you here.
Oh, sorry. There are two DOD instructions here, 1332.38 and 1332.39. And right now I'm at page 7 of instruction 1332.39.
Okay. Now which paragraph number?
6.11, which is just roughly in the middle of the page. Rating of medical impairments existing prior to service.
Okay. I understand what the regulation says. Now, link that to something in the record.
Again, to reiterate my previous remarks, there may be documents that are missing and haven't surfaced, but appellant relies on the fact that disability severance pay could only be awarded in this case with a pre-existing disability where the individual is accepted on a waiver if there had been service aggravation, which is defined as an increase in severity.
And where what authority do you give us for that?
Well, there is statutory authority in 12.
What is it? 12?
1203. Mm-hmm. And then the DOD instructions.
Go ahead.
Since there's a conflict in the opinions.
Counsel, let me direct your attention to page 39. Of DOD instruction 1332.38 regarding hereditary and or genetic diseases. The paragraph at the bottom is E3.P4. The last paragraph on that page.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Which discusses the disease presumed to have been incurred prior to entry into active duty. In this case, if I recall the record, the service member received a waiver upon entry.
Yes, he did, Your Honor.
And the sentence I'm referring to says, however, any aggravation of that disease incurred in the line of duty beyond that determined to be due to natural progression shall be deemed service aggravated. And I am still interested in hearing medical evidence that indicates this aggravation was beyond natural progression.
There is an extensive discussion in the statement of a physician from the hospital in Rota, Spain, about the fact that Mr. Stover, who had been able to perform all his duties, and they were very arduous duties, he was a NAVOPS firefighter, until trauma late. He'd been in service almost 6 years.
Do you want to point to the record site, counsel?
Pardon me?
What, the record site?
The record site on that is 162, 163, Your Honor.
And give me a moment, I'd like to get there with you. Okay, go ahead.
There is a conflict in the opinions of the military physicians, and I'll just say Dr. M, since I'm not sure how the doctor whose statement appears at R338 prefers to have his name pronounced. As to whether the increase or worsening in Mr. Stover's left foot disability was due to natural progress. Since there was a conflict, there's no basis for finding that the service department determination of aggravation was patently inconsistent with VA criteria. And if I may turn for a moment to appellant's first assignment of error, COTANT makes it clear that the burden for rebutting the presumption of aggravation is an erroneous one, and when there's a difference of medical opinion, even if 3.1M were not applicable, the board has not met its legal burden of rebutting the VA presumption of aggravation.
I'd like to stay on 3.1M for a moment. What do you suggest would be the criteria or the standard to look at in determining that something is patently inconsistent?
I would say addressing the standard first, the standard review should be de novo, since I see this as a question of law in the same sense that a determination as to whether there's clear and unmistakable evidence to rebut the presumption of soundness is under the court's jurisprudence a question of law. As far as the criteria to be considered, whether service departments patently inconsistent, I'd say suggest that the criteria should be equivalent to those used in determining whether there's clear and unmistakable evidence to rebut a presumption. In other words, a mere difference of opinion will not suffice. And here we have a difference of opinion between the military physicians and Dr. M. There was also a Dr. McLaughlin.
Well, wait a minute. Now, the difference of opinion, all the military doctors said is that he
he's unable to perform his duties than he was when he came in. I don't think there's any dispute that there's an increase in disability here. But except for your linking of the regulation to the statute, and I don't see any word aggravation in the statute, there's no opinion that I can see in the record where any medical officer in the department, in the Navy, says that this individual's club foot disability increased beyond the natural progression.
I reiterate, Your Honor, that it would not have been lawful for the service department to have awarded disability severance pay had not the criteria in the cited
You're drawing that conclusion based upon the definition of aggravation in the DOD reg, not even in the SECNAV reg. In the DOD,
well, I'd say DOD would trump SECNAV.
In the DOD reg, and you're linking that, you said that links to 1203.
Yes, Your Honor.
And what language in 1203 do you believe compels that finding?
Well, there is some confusion, but have to look at the statutory scheme as a whole and not take words out of context. When the word incurred is used in 1203, it's appellant's position that would include incurrence or aggravation of the disability. In other words, another way to look at it is Mr. Stover incurred additional disability in service above and beyond that disability which was present when he entered service, 10% versus 0%.
And there's no question about that. There's no question. I think I don't see the Secretary disputing that. The question is whether or not the increase in disability was beyond the natural progress of the disability or, condition, his club foot condition. That's the issue here.
But that is required by the...
Well, but you haven't showed it. You haven't, at least, I don't see where you... I hear you saying that, and I understood it in your briefs. I'm trying to find out how we can draw that legal conclusion.
Well, in the typical case, there would be a document in the file which has not surfaced to date, and it would say specifically EPTE aggravated in service. It might not use the word natural progress, but right. That's what aggravation
I understand.
Means.
I understand that. And I guess my difficulty here is that in the record, at least, I have not found it. And I'm not saying that if you can point me to it, I would be happy to look at it. I have not seen the words aggravation or beyond natural progress used in the military medical records. Now, if you can point me to that,
I cannot point you to those specific words, Your Honor.
Well, the document, counsel, that is in the record, Physical Evaluation Board document indicates that the veteran...
What record is that, Your Honor?
I'm sorry. It's on page 153. Concludes that the veteran is unfit for duty and cites unfitting conditions, being his congenital club foot... And the second page of that document indicates that he is to be separated with severance pay, but without further disability benefits. And finally, that the unfitting conditions were not combat related. Are you suggesting that there is a presumption contained in this document that the veteran's condition was indeed aggravated by service?
Under the DOD instructions, Your Honor, there is a
which
presumption of aggravation. Well, on page 21 of DOD Directive 1332.28, it discusses rebuttal of the presumption of.
Are we on point 28 or point 38?
1332.38. I misspoke. I'm sorry. 1332.38.
What page?
Page 21. It talks about the rebuttal of the presumption of aggravation.
Well, What paragraph?
Here's we go with the laundry list. EPP 1.3.4.1.3.1.
Okay, got it.
This is why I just use pages instead of those lengthy citations.
That, if we're looking at the same paragraph, this says for all cases with the finding of pre-existing condition without aggravation, the specific accepted medical principle for overcoming the presumption of service aggravation shall be cited and explained.
Well, the reason I'm citing that paragraph, Your Honor, it is one place where the words presumption of service aggravation is specifically mentioned. In other words, to rebut that presumption, accepted medical principles must be employed. No, there is a presumption of service aggravation.
Okay. Please continue, counsel.
If we were to not have 3.1 be at play, and we just were dealing with the presumption of aggravation, could you discuss how you feel that the board erred in that determination?
There were two medical opinions by Dr. McLaughlin, R288, Dr. M, R338. The parties agreed in a joint motion for remand that Dr. McLaughlin's opinion was equivocal or somewhat equivocal. If an opinion is equivocal or even somewhat equivocal, obviously it cannot be undebatable. So that leaves us with Dr. M's opinion. And the secretary apparently does not consider the fact that the opinion is tainted to be a reason for rejecting that opinion, yet the very questions posed to Dr. M were worded in terms of, is it at least as likely as not? Is it more likely than not? Interestingly enough, in the Kinnaman case, the physician who presented an opinion about the preexistence of Mr. Kinnaman's keratoconus and eye disorder said it was probable but not certain that the disability preexisted service. Well, if it's probable, that would certainly, if we have a preponderance of the evidence test, probable would get you there. But saying it's uncertain means it does not satisfy, as the court found, the standard of clear and unmistakable evidence.
But I believe in this case that Dr. Milicic did not use such equivocating language.
Nor did he use any language expressing a sense of certainty, and he was guided by the very questions posed to him in the engagement letter, which improperly stated the standard. A reasonable interpretation of Dr. M's opinion is it is more likely than not that the increase in severity was due to natural progress. That does not meet the test for clear and unmistakable evidence. And interpretive doubt, of course, is to be resolved in each and every case in the veteran's favor.
But counsel, here,
excuse me, I know your time has expired, but you know we've taken up a lot of your time looking at specific provisions of the record. If I don't have any objection, I would prefer that we continue this inquiry. And of course, the secretary, if you need more time, we'll be happy to give you that time. Go ahead.
Unlike in Kinnaman, here, there is no question regarding that the condition pre-existed induction.
But we're dealing with presumptions. In one case, presumption of soundness at entry. In the other case, presumption of aggravation. Each instance, pardon me, that presumption can only be overcome by clear and unmistakable evidence.
I would like to return to something that you said in responding to my last question, that you said that Dr. Milicic doesn't use any certainty in his opinion. I need more. I don't understand the basis for that statement. It seems to me he says it's my opinion that it's attributable to the natural progress. The complaints increased during military service are not beyond the natural progress of the disorder. subjective complaints are predictable. That seems to me to be quite certain, except for the, it is my opinion, but I...
Well, he certainly could have said unequivocally, this is what happened, or it is certain this is what happened. And also, appellant has another objection to that opinion. One case that I must admit appellant did not cite in his opening brief is Gabrielson, 7 Vet App at 40. And the court stated in Gabrielson that the government cannot evade its statutory reasons or basis responsibility merely by adopting an IME opinion as its own, where the IME fails to discuss all favorable evidence. Appellant would submit the fact that significant trauma was sustained during service by Mr. Stover is significant evidence, especially since it was after the trauma that it was all downhill for Mr. Stover. Before that event, he was able to perform PFT tests. He was able to perform arduous duties as a firefighter. Once the trauma was sustained, he ended up being found unfit for service, and with only 50% remaining function in his left lower extremity, which was not the situation when he entered service.
So are you pointing to the automobile door trauma as the,
yes,
the aggravating factor?
Yes, Your Honor. Or I'll rephrase that, an aggravating factor, not necessarily the aggravating factor, an aggravating factor. And certainly it was a significant item of evidence favorable to the appellant that should have been but was not discussed by Dr. M in his brief opinion. I'm willing to take a break and let the secretary proceed.
Any other questions?
Not right now.
Thank you.
You may take a break.
Okay. Excuse me. May it please the court. Once again, my name is Thomas Sullivan, representing the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, and assisting me at council table is Gail Stroman. Your Honors, as a preliminary matter, the Secretary would like to thank the court for the order on Friday. It was a nice little homework assignment, and it was very helpful to have an idea of what concerned the court with the particulars of this case. If I may, before I get to the questions, which I plan to devote most of my time to answering, I'd like to go to something that Judge Sholin brought up, and that was that the Secretary feels very confident that the Board lawfully found that there was clear and unmistakable evidence sufficient to rebut the presumption of aggravation, and that that clear and unmistakable evidence showed that any increase in severity to Mr. Stover's disability was the result of the natural progress of the disease. And I think you hit the nail on the head when you pointed directly to Dr. Milichick's opinion. The Secretary would assert that there, however the question is posed, that the doctor's words are unequivocal.
Now, one could argue that the way a question is posed elicits a certain answer. Is the fact that the question was potentially wrong or worded wrongly, that has absolutely no effect on the outcome?
I believe it could in some circumstances, but I don't believe that's what happened here. I think, in fact, if anything, the question was posed much more equivocally than the doctor's answer came back. So I think in this case, it turns that on its head. I think we actually got a more unequivocal opinion than perhaps the question might have even suggested at the outset. But I also think, just to not to cut you off, I think that it's important to note that the legal standard is making a determination of whether the legal standard has been satisfied is within the province of the board. That's the finder of fact. So the Secretary would assert that it would not be proper to require the medical expert to phrase his opinion so that it would particularly satisfy the legal standard.
Well, okay, let us assume that that is correct. In this particular instance, the board relied on not just Dr. Milicic's statement, but also on Dr., I believe it was McLaughlin, after the VA and the appellant had agreed that Dr. McLaughlin's opinion was equivocal and therefore not clearly and unmistakably. So does the reliance on both of these documents together to arrive at the determination that they were able to rebut the presumption, is there some problem with that in relying in sort of tainted evidence?
Well, I would submit to you, Your Honor, that there is no problem. I would say that to the extent that Dr. McLaughlin's opinion was held to be equivocal by the parties, that did not render it completely non-probative at all. And to the extent that there were conclusions within the opinion, I think that the board, as a finder of fact, with the responsibility to weigh all the evidence of record, the board had a responsibility not to cast Dr. McLaughlin's opinion aside and to look at it and to look at all of the evidence in coming to its conclusion. Now, I would say that with one caveat. To the extent that the court might find that the board's reliance on Dr. McLaughlin's opinion, that would be harmless. And I think the board acquits itself very well in the opinion because it gives a lengthy reasons and bases explanation of what it found in each opinion and why it found each opinion probative, why it found that the clear and unmistakable evidence standard was satisfied, and then went so far as to say, even if we throw out Dr. McLaughlin's opinion, that Dr. Milicic's opinion standing on its own is persuasive, does contain clear and unmistakable evidence.
But then it went on to say at 15, even if you discounted it, it appears to the board that Dr. McLaughlin might simply have been speaking hypothetically or in the alternative. So it's not so much that they are discounting it as they are somehow justifying the equivocating language in the doctor's opinion. So I don't know, it's not clear to me from the board's decision that they really did evaluate the two in isolation, such that they might have found the same outcome just based on Dr. Milicic's statement.
Well, in all fairness, Your Honor, I'm not sure that it's exactly clear to me, but it seems as if the board was making an attempt to do that, And I think the board recognized that there was a problem with the first opinion. Certainly the secretary would assert that there is no error in reliance upon the second opinion.
Okay. Mr. Sullivan, let's take this one step further and accept for the moment that the only opinion that's useful is Dr. Milicic's opinion. If we accept that the physical evaluation board's determination is implicit, a line of duty determination, and carries with it an implicit finding of aggravation, in that hypothetical, we now would have two medical judgments that are not consistent and therefore in conflict and therefore not evidence of clearly unmistakable.
Okay, this kind of goes to the heart of my argument, and I hope that I can articulate this. Okay. The Naval Disability System is a completely separate system from the VA compensation system. And the Navy findings serve a very particular purpose. They are to make a determination on whether or not a service member is fit for service and whether they should be separated. And if so, might they be entitled to some sort of retirement pay or severance pay? The VA begins the adjudication process with the line of duty determination that might provide information as to did something occur in service while the service member was on active duty. The VA then, in this particular case, On page 11, the board acknowledges the evidence suggesting aggravation, that the Navy found aggravation. And then the board went on to apply the VA regulations, and they applied the 1153 and the regulation 3.306 and the presumption of aggravation. And then they made the ultimate conclusion that there was clear and unmistakable evidence. So the VA adjudication system lies outside of the Navy's disability system. And I think it's important for us to remember that.
Except for one intersecting point, and that's 3.1M.
That's correct. Okay. That's correct.
Explain how that relates.
Well, I thought very long and hard for an analogy that I could give to the court, and what I came up with, for whatever it's worth, is that sometimes you have a civil prosecution, and it might end up in a certain result, and the victim then might file papers in a civil suit and try to hold the perpetrator civilly liable. So you have two different systems. They might share the same evidence. Some of the evidence that was admissible in the criminal trial could be used in the civil trial. There's different standards of weighing the evidence, and I think that's an apt analogy for what we have here.
Yeah, but 3.1M is pretty specific. It says the service department finding that an injury, disease, or death occurred in the line of duty will be binding on the Department of Veterans Affairs unless patently inconsistent with the requirements and laws administered by the department. So tell me what that means. The line of duty determination will be binding on the department.
I think it means exactly what it says. I think first we'd have to understand, for VA purposes, what is a line of duty determination.
And I think for that, would you, since they're referring to the service department finding of line of duty, wouldn't we go to the service department's regulations to determine
that? I think we could do that, and I would direct the court to the Secretary of the Navy's instruction, 1850.4C, Part 4, Paragraph 3410, I believe it is. And that would be found in 3-22 is the actual page number.
So that's really enclosure 3 to that regulation, right?
Yes, that's correct.
And the paragraph again?
The paragraph is 3410, okay. And it says line of duty.
Got it.
And this is the definitional part of the Secretary of the Navy's instructions. And we can see that the line of duty determination in the Navy is not dissimilar to how the VA statute 105A and its implementing regulation 3.1M also define line of duty. It's very similar.
Well, significantly, that regulation in paragraph B also says that any disease or injury discovered after the member's active military service, with the exception of congenital and hereditary conditions, is presumed to have been incurred in the line of duty.
That's correct. That is correct, and I think that's what happened here. I think that there's an assumption that somehow, because Mr. Stover didn't end up with benefits, that maybe the VA did something wrong. But I think if you look at page 11 of the board decision, you'll see it's a perfect example that every VA adjudication for service connection begins with a 3.1M finding, whether or not it's explicit, whether or not the board cites to 3.1M. It's what the VA has to do to begin the adjudication process. And I think that's supported by the Federal Circuit in Shedden versus Principi, because what the Federal Circuit said is line of duty means service connected, and it creates a presumption of service connection. But that they went on to explicate that that in no way meant that a veteran would be qualified for service connection compensation benefits.
But isn't this different than an ordinary service connection claim, in that this person was found disabled by the military at the time of separation? So the question of disability isn't really at play. It's the nature of that disability. Is it an aggravation or natural progression of the disease? So if that's all we're talking about, or we're talking about whether an injury occurred, if 3.1 says you have to be bound by the service department unless it's patently inconsistent, that seems to be a much higher threshold that the VA has to overcome than in a traditional service connection claim where there has been no finding prior to this veteran walking into a regional office seeking benefits. I'm having difficulty equating Shedden to this circumstance.
Okay. Wow, that kind of goes to the heart of some of the questions that you asked, so let's see how I do here. I think that it's important to understand here that the VA began with a finding of aggravation. The VA acknowledged that the Navy found aggravation, that the inquiry begins with the presumption of aggravation.
And that's all that 3.1 speaks to?
Yes.
But then how do you tie in the concept that the military wouldn't have granted him severance pay?
I'm actually really glad you asked that, because 1203 is a compensatory statute. 10 U.S.C. 1203 is a compensatory statute whereby the Navy, or the service department, in this case the Navy, will grant a service member military severance pay if they meet certain requirements. Among those requirements, one of the components of that needs to be satisfied in order to qualify under 1203 would be an affirmative line of duty finding. So in no way can the presumption of aggravation, the VA's presumption of aggravation, in any way invalidate or negate the Navy's finding. That the Navy's finding is taken on its face, and then VA moves forward. It's the beginning of the VA's inquiry. So a 1206 finding is the end of the Navy's inquiry.
If there was a finding in the record that specifically said that the Navy found, let's say the Physical Evaluation Board found, that this 10% disability rating that they gave was beyond the natural progression of the disability, would the VA, in your judgment, be bound by that finding?
Well, I would go so far as to concede, Your Honor, that that may be what the Navy said implicitly, okay? If we look really closely at the Navy's regs, there is no evidence to support that in the record. And so I protect myself with that caveat. But I think that it doesn't matter, because I think we begin at the VA with a presumption of aggravation. We get the line of duty finding.
Well, you begin with the presumption of aggravation, but if in fact your view is that 3.1N, which says the VA is bound by it, the question is whether or not that raises this, in this circumstance, the presumption to an irrebuttable presumption, because the finding that needs to be made, this factual finding, has already been made. And the VA has sort of delegated the responsibility of this finding to the service department. And therefore, once made, the VA, and under other cases too we have, can't go and try to find evidence against the veteran to try to rebut that finding.
Sure. I think what you've done is you've struck the heart of the matter. I think, the Federal Circuit in Kent versus Principi addressed the presumption of soundness. And they addressed this head on, the idea that could the somehow evidence from the service department be read in such a way to bind the VA and create
that was a presumption of soundness without 3.1M.
That's correct. But they did hold that you couldn't create an irrebuttable presumption.
I know, but here we have the secretary, it seems to me, in 3.1M. Again, if it applies, I'm not saying it
sure
does, but if we find this link, you have the secretary in the secretary's own regulation saying, look, we'll be bound by this.
Well, they also say, right below that, unless it's patently inconsistent.
Well, but patently inconsistent, that gets to another issue. Patently inconsistent with the law seems to be a legal issue, as opposed to a factual determination, factual medical determination that's made.
I would agree. I would agree. I think that is a legal determination. And I think that to the extent that the Secretary's briefs were confusing with regard to what the proper standard of review is, I would now like to state that the Secretary believes that the proper standard of review in determining whether something is patently inconsistent would be de novo review, that it is a question of law, and I think Shedden would support that as well, because Shedden discusses the concept of a presumption of service connection, that line of duty somehow creates a presumption of service connection, and if that were so, then that would create a rebuttable presumption in this court, and the laws of the VA have consistently, you know, held that that would be a de novo standard. So
what does 3.1M add above and beyond the presumption of aggravation to justify its existence?
I think what 3.1M does, Your Honor, and historically the regulation was in place, it acknowledges the VA understands that sometimes the service department is in the best position to determine when somebody entered service, when somebody left service, the conditions under which they left service, the character of that discharge, etc. And in every VA adjudication, the line of duty finding would come into play. And I think I have no real authority for this except from my understanding of the VA system, is that you have formal line of duty findings, and you would have what we might call informal line of duty findings, where appellants have put forth that, you know, a doctor might have noted in their service medical records that something occurred in service. And the VA always begins that their inquiry as to whether a veteran would be entitled to benefits with those findings. That's the first element that VA has to find is satisfied before the agency can then begin to award benefits.
Counsel, let's return to a question Judge Sholin asked earlier regarding patently inconsistent.
Sure.
Assuming that there is a line of duty determination,
okay,
what would make it patently inconsistent with the laws and regulations in this case?
Well, I would submit, Your Honor, it would run roughshod over the VA adjudication system. It would not allow the VA to apply VA regulations. And the board, of course, is required to do that.
But let's be specific here. Exactly what are you referring to?
Well, I'm referring to a couple things. One, it would create the irrebuttable presumption that Judge Hagel referred to. It would say that if the Navy finds aggravation, ergo service connection. And I think what that would do is it would gut the VA code. It would gut Title 38. We would no longer have the presumption of aggravation. We would no longer have the other elements that need to be required to satisfy the full equation in order to grant entitlement to benefits. So I think I did a search, a lengthy federal case search over the weekend, and I couldn't find any legally established criteria for what patently inconsistent.
You just anticipated my next question.
Was.
Oh, that's great. Go ahead.
I'll offer this for what it's worth. In Supreme Court dissents, in many other federal cases, in various circuit courts, and also some of the sister courts of this court, the cases seem to say that there was a patent inconsistency when one law tended to prevent another law from being effectuated, or when the application of a statute, a regulation, or a policy might violate or contradict another statute, regulation, or established doctrine of the law. So, for whatever it's worth, I think this one's for the court. There really isn't any established legal criteria, but the Secretary would submit that if it tends to prevent another law from being effectuated, which we believe would happen here, and if it violates or contradicts the application of another statute or regulation, then that would be patently inconsistent. Your Honors, I still have a little time left, and I'm not sure if you have any other questions for me. But if not, I would like to say that the Secretary is confident that there is enough evidence in this record to affirm the May 30, 2002 board decision. And thank you very much.
Mr. Landers?
I guess I have some of my rebuttal or all my rebuttal time left.
You have it all.
Oh, okay. One citation in the DOD regs that I did not mention specifically in my earlier remarks is in DOD instruction 1332.39, and this time I'll try to give a paragraph number as well as a page number. It's page 8, paragraph 6.11.3. In cases involving service members with permanent service aggravation and a current degree of impairment less than total, the rating will reflect only the degree of disability over and above that existing at the time of entrance into active service. Record 153 reflects that this is exactly what was done in this case with the 0% rating assigned for the left foot condition at entry into service.
I'm sorry, I'm slow following. What page on that was it?
Oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor. Page 8.
Page 8.
DOD instruction 1332.39.
Okay.
And it's at the very top. It's part of paragraph 6.11.3.
Okay, thank you. I've got it now.
Okay. The fact, and I can't emphasize this enough, that disability severance pay was awarded shows that the service department determined that there was a worsening of the condition beyond natural progress. Mr. Stover should not be penalized, maybe because one or more records are missing. Next point I would like to make is that the Secretary's regulations require, as does Gabrielson that I cited earlier, that all the evidence of record be evaluated. Nowhere in the board's decision did I find any analysis of the findings by the service department physicians. They were reported, but they were not discussed. Counsel for the secretary, if I am quoting him correctly, maybe I'm paraphrasing, but I believe he stated that the board attempted to explain why Dr. M's opinion constituted clear and unmistakable evidence. Pound would submit that an attempt will not suffice. Merely attempting to provide an adequate explanation is not the same as actually providing that explanation. Also, I'd like to emphasize that while granted the board as the trier of fact makes credibility determinations, questions of law are adjudicated de novo by this court with no deference to the board, and the ultimate question of whether the presumption of soundness is rebutted by clear and unmistakable evidence is a question of law. And once again, I would like to also emphasize the fact that where there is a difference of medical opinion on such matters as to whether the acknowledged increase in severity or worsening the disability in service was beyond natural progress, if there's a difference of opinion, that cannot amount to clear and unmistakable evidence that the increase was due to natural progress. And where the criteria utilized by the service department and VA track one another, if not being absolutely identical, and the service department finds in the veteran's favor, I fail to see where the secretary has shown to this date that finding by the service department, which resulted in an award of severance pay, was patently inconsistent with VA criteria. The service department was not using foreign criteria. The service department did not make any findings of fact or offer any medical opinions that were not in accordance with the record. Therefore, appellant fails to see how the secretary has established or met his burden of showing that the favorable line of duty determination by the service department was patently inconsistent with VA criteria.
Mr. Landers, let me return to a question I asked earlier, and maybe you have a different answer. Can you point to any evidence in the record that determines that the injury was aggravated beyond the natural progress of the disease?
I would point to the fact that Mr. Stover was admitted to service on a waiver. Had it not been felt that he could perform the duties of service requirements, he would not have been granted the waiver. The evidence shows that he was able to hunt and fish and hike and engage in arduous manual labor before service. After 6 years of service, or just before the six-year mark, he became unfit for service. The medical evidence supplied by the medical board and to the medical board clearly shows that the presumption of aggravation, which arose when there was this increase in severity, has not been rebutted by showing mere natural progress. This is not the matter of an individual who the first day or week of basic training started complaining about foot pain and was discharged shortly after, or an individual who sat on his duff on a chair in the Pentagon during his several years of service. This was an individual who performed arduous duties in states and overseas. He was awarded a Southeast Asia Medal with Bronze Star. And duties as a firefighter certainly put a lot of stress and strain.
Counsel, I appreciate all of that, but I'm looking for evidence in the record. Can you cite evidence in the record?
Well, I believe I previously cited the medical report from Rota, Spain. And the
that medical report did not address the issue of whether the injury was aggravated beyond natural progress of the disease specifically.
Well, I believe that would be the province of the medical board and the physical evaluation board and the physical review council to determine, rather than the physician who's evaluating the veteran's condition, comparing.
That would be an administrative determination.
I believe Justice Scholin earlier mentioned the presumption of regularity in that regard.
Your reliance on 3.1M. 3.1M, again, the language that we're concerned about says the service department finding that the injury, disease, or death occurred in the line of duty will be binding on the department. That's the phrase that you seek to use to say that there's a compelled finding of aggravation or of increase in disability beyond the natural progress, correct?
Unless it's the finding is patently inconsistent.
Right. Well, if we go to the Secretary of the Navy instruction and look at the definition of line of duty, the paragraph that was cited, 3410 of enclosure 3.
Unfortunately, I don't have that in my possession. I was not provided.
Okay. Well, let me tell you what it says, and I'll even show it to you after I read it, okay? It basically talks about line of duty. It starts off, says, disease or injury incurred by naval personnel while on active service will be considered incurred in the line of duty. And then it gives a number of circumstances. And basically those circumstances deal with the individual's misconduct, whether they were avoiding duty during service, whether they were in a period of unauthorized absence, whether they were confined, and so forth. I don't see that link to the medical condition that we're talking about. In the line of duty, as discussed by the Secretary's counsel, Mr. Sullivan, and also by Shedden, seems to be a different determination than the conclusion you're asking us to draw. Now, do you want to take a look at that paragraph?
For Secretary provided to me. What this language seems to address is one aspect of line of duty. There are really two aspects. One is, was it due to misconduct, which would include AWOL, desertion, et cetera, under influence of bad substances. so on. The other aspect is whether there was some relationship to the incurrence or aggravation of disability and performance of active duty. And I feel that Kinnaman, which was so ably argued by counsel for Mr. Kinnaman, made it perfectly clear in its holding that 3.1M certainly covers the conditions that are outside the realm of misconduct, because Kinnaman did not involve misconduct, AWOL, or anything of that nature. It was a matter of the only difference between Kinnaman in this case is in Kinnaman we're dealing with a presumption of soundness induction, and in this case we're dealing with the presumption of aggravation. And it seems to me that the court's black letter case law is clear that 3.1M would apply in a case such as the one before us. Any more
questions?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. The case is submitted. The court will greet counsel.
All rise. This court is adjourned until further notice.
The court, you too, the court in the old days could be much rougher.